Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications. Today, the Western Producer's Ed White investigates how proposed changes to tax laws could affect Canadian farm families.
They do seem to be trying to close off ways that people hide from paying their fair share of taxes.
Alexis Stockford of the Manitoba Cooperator reports on open farm days.
There's like a bison farm, there are a couple of horticulture type locations, there's a strawberry farm, stables, beekeepers, a couple of organic producers.
And Phil Franz Workington of Commodity News Service Canada takes a look at the markets.
There's a million tons less peas, a million tons less lentils, so it's smaller pulse supplies, but that was kind of expected.
All on Between the Rows with today's host, Gord Gilmore.
Hello, and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. There's been a lot of talk lately about proposed changes to federal tax law, specifically a crackdown on the use of personal corporations to lower tax bills. Much of that attention has been centered on how it will affect professionals like doctors and lawyers. However, it also appears the effects will be felt down on the farm. We're joined now by the Western Producer's Ed White, who investigated this in their latest issue. Hi, Ed. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Gord.
So, the federal government says the changes to small business taxes are designed to close loopholes that people are using to dodge paying their fair share of taxes. First off, is that true? Is that what's happening? And do farmers have anything to worry about?
Well, it certainly seems to be what the federal government is highlighting when they explain why they're doing this big raft of changes. And it's a lot of changes. I've got in front of me 62 pages that they have on the Finance Department website explaining what they are, which actually includes some algebra and things like that. So it's complicated stuff. But they do seem to be trying to close off ways that people hide from paying their fair share of taxes. I guess the challenge is farms are small businesses, just like a lawyer's office or an accountant's office or a doctor's office might be, except they have very specific differences, such as lots and lots of land and various other things that don't apply to those other kinds of professionals. And what I've heard from tax, accounting, and management professionals I've talked to is that there are some real worries in this, in how it might be applied to farmers and really muck up how farmers have organized their farms in the last 20 years or so.
So when you talk to those professionals, what are the key things that they're worrying about that are coming down the pike then, or maybe coming down the pike?
Well, there's three big categories that most people have mentioned to me. One is that within a small private corporation, which is what a farm often is, however you arrange that, if it's incorporated, you can do what's called income sprinkling by the government. Most people know that as income splitting. And that means that between the various members of the family, you can divide out the earnings of the company, which is the farm, to the people in your family. So that might be all sorts of different percentages. And it can be used as a way to minimize your taxes so that everybody pays as little tax as possible. And that's a very common tax planning strategy. And there, it can be obviously abused by some companies, and the people that lots of people try to point to and have an accusing finger at are things like if a doctor has a practice, it's just his own practice, but he divides out his income in a number of ways, so not so much tax is being paid as really should be if it was just taxed as income. But with farmers, it's really hard to tell who's actually working on the farm in kind of the way you would charge for wages. So if it's one spouse does most of the work in the field, but another does lots of banking and accounting and various other things, maybe even like a lot of women on farms do a lot of cooking for big crews of harvesting folks all through the harvest season. Well, does that count as farm work? What doesn't? Same with kids who help around the farm. What percentage of the farm's work are they actually doing? And the thing with the rule changes is you now can just declare these percentages and take the money out that way. In the future, you'll have to actually justify the exact percentages you're taking out from the farm. So if you are paying 50-50 to husband and wife And CRA, Canadian Revenue Agency, thinks, well, that sounds a bit dodgy. You better show me how the one spouse who's not running all the machinery actually gets 50% of that income earned by them. You might have a challenge doing that unless you've got it very well documented. And there's various factors that go into that. People also use this income splitting to help fund their kids' university education. You know, while the kids, maybe they never got paid all through their teenage years helping around the farm. But when they're in university, maybe they'll get paid a share of the farm's profits. In the future, that might not be possible at all. That might be penalized if you do that, if you can't justify them as a farm worker that year. So that's just one of the areas that's getting affected. Another is changes to capital gains exemptions. And, you know, as most people in farm country know, people have been encouraged to incorporate their farms and find ways better than just having dad eventually die and having in his will his secret plans on how to divide out the farm. We've encouraged farmers to begin early, finding different ways, such as incorporation, to begin revealing or even spreading out the land ownership and other parts of the farm ownership. But with some of these changes, there's a possibility that if you are viewed as a non-farming member of the family, and that could be a kid who has moved away and is in a different city, but dad wants to give them, or dad and mom want to give them, a share of the farm's value. If you spread out the land by beginning to give the ownership to these other people, you know, giving them shares in the company, if they're seen as non-farming people, they could be nailed as if they had received cash. That's a possibility. And that's a big point here, is we don't really know how all this stuff will be applied eventually if it does ever become law. But these are things that people have raised to me as worries. And I guess the third area that everybody is focusing on in farm tax circles seems to be what happens if you leave cash in your company at beyond 10% of the value of the company. The government sees that generally in many situations as people try to hide from paying taxes on that money that should be taxed as income. But in the case of a farm, a lot of times farmers will pile up money so they can buy either land in the future or machinery in the future, and they don't want to necessarily do that all on debt. Well, now if you're storing up cash in the company in the good years, it could be seen as you trying to dodge taxes, and then you get hit with some sort of a penalty. So those are three areas where a lot of farm accounting people have, I guess, raised red flags to me and others about this.
This looks sort of complex, lots of moving parts. And as we all know, there's no two farms that are identical financially. So how does a farmer go about finding out how or whether these tax changes will affect their farm individually?
Yeah, well, I think the obvious thing for farmers to do would be to turn to whatever professionals they use. I assume most farms that are incorporated would have accountants, maybe tax planners, maybe management advisors, people like that that actually understand this very complex area and can go through the 62 pages and see how those things might, in the real world, apply to their actual unique farming operation. If you don't have that, or you want more, or you just want to double check on the advice you're getting so that you round it out a bit better, there are various websites. I mean, you can go and look directly at the government proposals on the Department of Finance website. And you can also go to various other firms that are offering advice. If, say, you're a Myers Norris Penny customer, client, on their site, you can type in your client codes and get in. But if you're not a client of theirs, you got to look around for free stuff. So there are other places. One that I looked at the other day was a tax law firm called Moody's Gardner in Calgary. So that's just another example of the kinds of places that are offering this advice online for farmers to sort of think their way through this pretty complex issue.
So, now, if you're a farmer who is alarmed by these changes or concerned by them, is there an opportunity to talk to the government about this before it becomes law?
Yeah, and every farm group I speak to is strongly advising farmers to, even though it's harvest, and this is the last thing in the world anyone wants to think about while you're trying to bring in your crop, there's only until October 2nd for anyone to give feedback to this before they then take it back and work through their proposals again. And they can do that directly online. It looks like it's quite easy. I was on the website earlier today looking at it. If they go to fin.gc.ca, right on the front of the webpage of the Department of Finance is a tab you can click on to give feedback about these proposals.
So I saw this morning, actually, while I was preparing, the Prime Minister came out recently and said he won't apologize for asking wealthy people to pay more. So my sense on reading that was that their minds are kind of made up. Is this a done deal, or do you think there is any chance of changing some of these proposals?
Well, I think definitely history shows us that you can change these things. And I'll just go back to the other day, a person I called up because I thought he would be uniquely qualified because of history to talk about this was Jason Kenney, who is not just a former conservative cabinet minister, but also was head of the Canadian Taxpayers Federation when they, in the 90s, during the Chrétien era, ran a series of rallies and other protests against proposed tax changes. And those changes were very much either weakened or abandoned, because there was such an uproar, as you might be seeing happen now. This has gotten quite a lot of attention already. So from what I've heard from all the different farm groups I've spoken to, there's a recommendation that people, if they do want to get the political level of Ottawa, knowing how they feel about it, you know, call your MP, especially if you have a Liberal MP, let them know, because they'll certainly be listening very carefully to what their constituents are saying and how this is going across in the real world out there.
Great. Thanks a lot. That was the Western Producers, Ed White. Thanks for joining us today, Ed.
Yeah, thanks.
This is Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. Across the country, the agriculture sector wants Canadians to know more about food and farms. But how can that happen? In Manitoba, the industry gets together every fall to host an open farm day at locations throughout the agricultural region of the province. We're joined now by Manitoba Cooperator reporter Alexis Stockford, who wrote about these efforts in the most recent issue of that publication. Hi, Alexis, and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, not a problem, Gord.
So what's the open farm lineup look like this year?
So there are a couple more locations than previous years. So there are 46 this year, and geographically they have a wide range. So like there's a couple down in southeastern Manitoba all the way down to Vida, and then if you go diagonally across the province all the way up to Roblin. So quite a geographic range. And the actual locations themselves are equally varied. So you've got like the big sectors, so like the beef and the chicken and the dairies. But there are also a couple of more niche sectors that are also involved this year. So there's a bison farm. There are a couple of horticulture type locations. There's a strawberry farm, stables, beekeepers, a couple of organic producers. And then there are actually a couple of locations that are not actually farms. They're things like research centers. So the Manitoba Beef and Forage Initiative research farm out by Brandon, the Glen Lee Research Farm, and then there are a bunch of museums and stuff as well.
So I'm also told that in a sign of the changing times, there's a bit of a sort of a social media push this year. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, like just in general, there's been more of an effort just for some online promotion and trying to get the word out on the event this year. But there is a little bit more activity on their Facebook page. They have been sort of profiling a couple of the locations that are coming up and just posting pictures, telling people what they can expect at the various locations and stuff like that. And then they've also actually launched a hashtag this year. So hashtag Open Farm Day 17. And I'm sure they're hoping that as the day gets a little bit closer, that's going to start picking up steam.
So one of the whole points of this exercise is getting people more used to the idea of food sourcing and out of the cities, see where their food comes from, what goes into agriculture, what a farm actually looks like in a lot of cases. I think there are a lot of people out there who've never even seen one. So is it actually accomplishing that, or is it the industry kind of talking to itself? Do we have some sense on what the urban uptake is?
The sense I get is that it varies depending on where the locations are. What I've been told is that the locations that are kind of clustered close to the urban centers get actually quite a bit of traffic. from cities, and mostly because it's a completely novel experience, right? As opposed to some of the ones that are a little bit farther out from the cities, and it's more of a drive and it's more inconvenient. That being said, there have been a couple of instances where people from the city have driven all the way out to, like I said, the Manitoba Beef and Forage Initiative out in Brandon. So there are a couple of, highlight locations that seem to draw the urban visitors a little bit farther. I also might point out that it might be a little bit different for some of the museums as well. Some of the locations that are maybe a little bit more novel for the rural people as well. So like the research farms and the museums, they might draw a little bit more of an even demographic, I guess, and a more even split between the rural and the urban.
When you were doing your story, did you get any sense as to why people on the farm end participate in this, why they host, why, you know, what motivates them? Do you have any sense of that?
I think part of it is just an idea that they're wanting people to know what it is that they do. I think in the farm industry, there's a perspective of farmers that they feel like they're maybe a little bit misunderstood, or they maybe feel like all these people in the cities, they go out to and they buy their food in the supermarket and they don't know where the food comes from, and they're wanting to be actively part of the solution to that, and just educating people, I think. And then I think honestly, for a couple of people, it becomes a thing that they do, right? So it becomes a thing where they enjoy planning it out. They enjoy planning different activities. And in some cases, they have other relatives or other like friends of the family that come out to help them put it on. So it becomes a bit of a social thing.
Mm-hmm. So I've heard also that this year, as well as the sort of online social media push, that we have a 4-H aspect to this, that they've gotten more involved. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, there is a little bit of a 4-H aspect to this. It ties into, 4-H in Manitoba this year has basically adopted a theme of leadership and community engagement. And this, of course, fits in very nicely with that. And so as part of that, they've been actively promoting the Open Farm Day. My understanding is that there are five families or five locations on the schedule this year that are 4-H families. Now that doesn't necessarily mean that at all of those locations they're going to advertise themselves as 4-H families. They just decided to do this kind of independently. It's also worth noting that the Roland 4-H Museum is also on the schedule, and that of course has a rich history, given that it's actually the home of 4-H in Canada.
So it sounds like a wide variety, lots to pick from. It might be a bit of a stretch to sort of figure out what to go to. Where can people find out a little bit more and sort of do their due diligence before they head out?
There's a lot of information that's posted on the website, so www.openfarmday.ca. And on there they have the full list of the host sites, as well as a couple of descriptions. Like what they can expect at the various sites. They have some maps and directions. So people can definitely find the information they need there.
Great, Alexis. Thanks for telling us about this effort.
Yeah, not a problem, Gord. Thanks so much.
Up next is Commodity News Services Canada's Phil Franz-Workington with the latest from the grain markets. You're listening to Between the Rows, and I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. Last week, Statistics Canada released its first production survey of the year on August 31st. Commodity News Service Canada's Phil Franz-Workington joins us now to tell us a bit about them. Thanks for joining us, Phil.
You're welcome, Gord. Good to be here.
So let's jump right in. Was there anything interesting in those numbers?
Yeah, I think this year's canola crop, they pegged it at 18.2 million tons. That was pretty much in line with what, most industry people had been thinking ahead of the report. But what was interesting was last year's number. The StatsCan had it at about 18.5 million tons, but they upped it in the report to 19.6 million. So that's up a million ton adjustment. So the kind of the export pace, the domestic crush over the past year, meant that the revision wasn't that surprising, or we'd be having negative supplies out there. But the you know, the fact that they changed it by that much in this report still kind of highlights you know, the general questions that come with every StatsCan report, that, you know, maybe this year's number might also be on the low side, and we'll see a bigger canola crop in future reports once we get more harvest results and all that.
So those sort of revisions, are they typical? I've kind of heard from others that this report isn't exactly well regarded because its timing kind of leads to unreliability, and they seem to go back and kind of reissue numbers on a regular basis. Do you have any sense of that?
Yeah, because this survey, they conducted the survey in late July, so at that time nobody's harvested anything yet, really. So it's more of a guessing game what farmers are telling StatsCan, and then you know, there's always a bit of fudging on numbers there as well. But yeah, this is kind of their first crack at it, and there'll be two more revisions with the in December they'll have kind of their final production number, which, you know, will be kind of what people go off of at the time. But as we've seen this year, even the final December number can change going forward. So StatsCan is renowned for revisions in future reports.
Now, aside from canola, was there anything else that stood out to you in this report?
The one thing that stood out was the durum number. It was down quite a bit on the year. That decline in durum was expected, but I don't think to the extent that StatsCan showed. So they had durum at 3.9 million tons. That's down from 7.8 million last year. So that's a pretty big drop in the amount of durum around. And so that the durum drop was the largest factor moving the all wheat number down from 31.7 million last year. This year, only 25.5 million tons of wheat. So, you know, the U.S. markets kind of look at that headline number out of Canada and find some support from that. But, you know, it was kind of the all wheat number is in line with what everyone was expecting, really, heading into the year or into the harvest. Everything, you know, most crops were down a bit on the year, which was expected given the adverse weather. We've seen more in Saskatchewan and Alberta this year, so there's a million tons less peas, a million tons less lentils, so it's smaller pulse supplies, but that was kind of expected.
So ordinarily a smaller crop, that would be exciting from a pricing standpoint. How do you see that playing out this year?
Yeah, that does it is supportive for prices. Not the best news for those growers that are the reason behind the smaller crops, I suppose, if they don't have anything to sell. But supplies are down, so that should bode well for prices. But you know, on most crops, we're a small player in the big wide world. But one interesting thing is crops are, you know, production might be a bit lower, but the quality is much better than last year when, you know, disease was a big issue that last year, but this year that's not really the case. So quality is up, so that will, for what is being sold, it'll be in the higher quality classes, and that brings in better prices as well.
So beyond our sort of typical seasonal harvest issues, you know, the quality of the crop actually coming in, what are some of the less tangible things that are moving the markets right now?
Well, we've got the hurricanes down in the States, Hurricane Harvey, and the next one coming with I'm blanking on its name, Irma, maybe. But the weather there is kind of you know, being watched. The soybeans and corn in the States, they're farther away from their main harvest, but, you know, if that weather impacts things one way or the other, it's also kind of leading to, you know, disruptions in the Gulf of Mexico for shipping out U.S. Grain, so that kind of works its way up into our markets as well. Another thing to watch would be the Canadian dollar. It's was up again this morning, and so it's at the strongest levels in about 2 years. And the so stronger Canadian dollar generally means weaker Canadian grain and oilseed prices, because we're shipping into the international markets, and that kind of cuts into the market there. One other thing, September 6th, Wednesday, the Stats Canada will put out its stocks, ending stocks numbers. So they're, you know, will be after the big adjustment in the canola production number, that's probably going to, you know, come to play in an adjustment in the ending stocks number, because if they had been running with what they were, it would be a negative ending stock. So pretty much Stats can up their canola ending, or their canola production number, by 1.2 million tons. So we're kind of thinking that the ending stocks might be at 1.2 million tons, and, you know, then all the numbers will line up once again for a brief period at least.
So. Phil Franz-Workington follows grain markets for Commodity News Service Canada in Winnipeg. Thanks for joining us, Phil.
You're welcome.
That's another edition of Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. Remember to stay safe during this busy time, and we hope you'll join us next week for another edition.
Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to btr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.